gold, the Bitcoin hold.com. The Bitcoin self-custody is the whole. Find the strength inside your soul. Your soul. Oh, the Bitcoin hold.com.
So, imagine you decide to build a physical bank vault, right? To store your life savings.
Right, like the thickest concrete, blast-proof titanium doors, the works.
Exactly. You pour the foundation, you forge the door, and you design this cryptographic lock that would, you know, take a supercomputer a billion years to brute force. And you step back and think, well, it's impenetrable.
And I mean, from a structural standpoint, you're right. It is.
Yeah, but what if the vulnerability isn't the steel or the concrete at all? What if the vulnerability is the person holding the combination? Like, they're standing outside the vault reading this highly convincing, utterly fabricated email that says the building is on fire and they need to open the door right now.
Yeah, it's the ultimate security paradox, really. As the cryptographic walls protecting our Bitcoin get higher and thicker, the path of least resistance for an attacker isn't breaking the wall anymore. It's tricking the human being into just opening the door from the inside.
Which is exactly why we're here. Welcome to this week's deep dive. If you're joining us, our mission for this episode is to just completely bypass the market noise, ignore the daily price ticker distraction, and focus strictly on the signal.
Yeah, we have a pretty dense stack of sources for this week.
We really do. We're looking at the latest developments in Bitcoin self-custody, infrastructure, and operational security. And based on what happened this week, it makes you realize that self-custody is it's a serious ongoing craft.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the tools are getting incredibly sophisticated, but the responsibility sitting on your shoulders as the user, well, it's as heavy as it's ever been.
Right. So let's start with the foundation of that responsibility, which is the physical hardware. We had a major coordinated disclosure this week from Tropic Square and Ledger Don John regarding the Trezor Safe 7.
Yeah, this was a massive transparency win for the space.
It really was. So Ledger Don John, acting as this independent auditor, successfully executed something called a laser fault injection attack. And they used this to bypass the firmware boot signature on the TropiCC01 secure element chip.
Which sounds like something out of a James Bond movie, honestly.
It really does. But before we get into the implications for the user, I need you to translate that for us. Like, how does a literal laser bypass a cryptographic signature?
Right. So to understand the attack, you kind of have to visualize the physical reality of a microchip. A secure element is essentially just a tiny, highly specialized computer.
Okay.
So when you power on a hardware wallet, the chip runs a boot process, and part of that process is a security check. The silicon literally asks itself, you know, is the firmware loaded on this device authentic? Is it signed by the manufacturer?
And if it is, it boots up.
Exactly. And if no, it locks down to protect your keys. But what the auditors did here was they physically decapped the chip.
Decapped, like took the top off.
Yeah, meaning they removed the protective outer packaging to expose the raw silicon underneath. Then they put it in highly specialized lab equipment, and they fired this precisely timed laser pulse at a specific microscopic transistor on that chip.
Wait, at the exact nanosecond it was running that firmware check?
Yes. That's the crazy part. The energy from the laser alters the voltage in that specific sector of the chip for just a fraction of a second.
Wow.
And it causes a computation error. So instead of registering the invalid firmware and locking down, the glitch basically forces the chip to just skip the security check entirely and proceed with the boot process.
That is wild. So it physically glitches the hardware while it's quote-unquote thinking.
That is the perfect way to describe it, yeah.
Okay, but I want to be super clear for anyone listening right now who uses one of these devices. An attacker cannot do this over Wi-Fi, right?
No, absolutely not. Mm. There is no remote exploit here at all. Your funds are totally safe from internet-based attacks.
So they literally have to steal your physical device, take it to a multi-million dollar lab, crack it open, and shoot it with a laser.
Yes, but you know, it's truly vital to take away from these sources the culture of security that this represents.
Right, the open source ethos.
Exactly. Historically, secure element manufacturers rely on what we call security through obscurity. They hide their chip architecture, cross their fingers, and hope nobody finds the flaws.
Which is a terrible long-term strategy.
It really is. But Tropic Square designed the TripoTCO1 specifically to be open and auditable. They actually invited Ledger Donjan to attack it.
Proactive transparency.
Yeah. They find the physical vulnerability in a lab so they can engineer software mitigations before a bad actor can actually exploit it in the wild.
That makes total sense. It's a highly localized physical threat model. But, I mean, it still relies heavily on the physical integrity of the manufacturer's housing.
It does.
Like, if someone steals your device or intercepts it in the mail before it even reaches you, you're trusting that the plastic shell hasn't been tampered with.
Which is exactly why the sources are also highlighting this growing counter-movement in the space, right?
Mm-hmm.
Modularity and DIY security.
Yeah, treating the hardware wallet as this monolithic, sacred object is kind of falling out of favor among advanced users.
Oh, totally. And that's what's driving the community efforts around things like the open source keycard shell we saw documented this week.
Right, where people are just 3D printing their own hardware wallet cases.
Yeah, it's the exact same underlying philosophy.
Yeah.
Rather than trusting the factory sealed plastic from the manufacturer, users are downloading these 3D printable files from GitHub and literally manufacturing the physical housing themselves.
So if you print your own case and you physically insert the secure element into it yourself, you just eliminate a massive portion of the supply chain risk.
Precisely. If that plastic shell cracks, or, you know, if you suspect an evil maid handled it while you were away at a hotel, you don't have to go buy a whole new device.
You just pop it out.
Yeah. You physically remove the keys, the secure element itself, and swap it into a fresh, verifiable housing that you printed. You take total ownership of the physical security layer.
I love that. But, you know, the reality is a villain with a laser lab or an evil maid tampering with your hardware is exceptionally rare for the average person.
Very rare, yeah.
A laser might crack the silicon, but the actual weakest link in literally any security setup is the human mind.
Without a doubt.
Attackers know the hardware is getting incredibly resilient, so they're pivoting to the path of least resistance. They are targeting your inbox.
And the evolution of social engineering we're tracking in the reports this week is, frankly, it's deeply concerning. We are way past the era of poorly spelled spam emails from fake princes.
Oh, yeah. The most glaring example from the week is this man-in-the-middle phishing attack that Zach Herbert discovered.
Yeah, this one is terrifying.
The attackers are using actual Google infrastructure to execute this. Like, they aren't spoofing a Gmail address. They are actively adding victims to real Google groups.
Right.
How does that even bypass a spam filter?
Well, because to the spam filter, the email is completely legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
When an attacker uses a real Google group to send a notification, the email originates directly from Google's own servers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it carries all the correct cryptographic signatures, like the DKIM and SPF records, that email providers use to verify sender identity. The spam filter looks at it, sees a mathematically verifiable Google signature, and just drops it straight into your primary inbox.
And the subject line reads something like, "Your Google data has been exported."
Which immediately spikes your cortisol.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
You panic. You assume someone has access to your drive or your seed phrase backups. So you open the email, and the link inside uses a legitimate Google URL shortener.
Yep.
You click cancel request, and it redirects you to a real-looking Google site, actually hosted on sites.google.com. It even hits you with a genuine reCAPTCHA to prove you're human.
And that reCAPTCHA is just a brilliant psychological trick.
It really is.
Because we've been conditioned to associate those puzzles with high-security environments, right? It lowers your guard. You think, oh, this must be secure. They're checking if I'm a bot.
Mm-hmm.
But once you solve it, you are dropped onto a perfectly cloned phishing page designed to just intercept your login credentials and your two-factor authentication tokens in real time.
It's so insidious. And the sources show this isn't an isolated tactic at all. Scammers are actively capitalizing on the Trezor disclosure we just discussed.
Oh, of course they are.
Yeah, they're sending out these fake, quote-unquote, urgent firmware update emails, just preying on people who skimmed a headline and are terrified their device is vulnerable to a laser attack.
Right, leveraging the news against the user.
Exactly. There's another campaign using the domain BitcoinKeeperPolicyReview.org to trick users into handing over credentials under the guise of an updated terms of service.
The common denominator across all these attacks is the weaponization of urgency.
Yeah.
Attackers are using AI tools now to generate highly convincing personalized copy at massive scale. They just want to short circuit your critical thinking. Because if you are panicking about lost data or vulnerable firmware, you are not inspecting the URL carefully.
But if attackers are using real Google infrastructure and AI is generating these flawless, context-aware panic scenarios, how does an average person actually defend themselves?
Well, the defense requires a shift in your fundamental operational security. You can no longer rely on, looking for a padlock icon in the browser or trusting the sender's address.
Right. Those indicators are dead.
They are. The core rule you must adopt is this. Never paste sensitive data into web forms from a link you clicked. Ever.
Just don't click the link.
Exactly. Whether it's a password, a seed phrase, or a passphrase, you have to assume any data entered into a browser form after following an email link is compromised. If an email creates a sense of panic, that is your immediate signal to stop.
Stop, breathe, and verify independently.
Yes. Close the email. Open a fresh browser window yourself. Manually type in the service's known URL and verify the status of your account that way.
Right. And because the internet is just fundamentally hostile to the human mind at this point, we're seeing wallet developers respond by physically severing that connection.
Yeah, the hardware isolation trend.
Exactly. The major wallet updates in the sources this week are heavily focused on building safer, dedicated off-ramps that isolate the user from the internet entirely.
Because if the internet connection is the vector for the phishing attack, the most robust solution is to just ensure the device holding your private keys literally never touches a network.
So Blockstream just executed a total revamp of their Jade hardware wallet lineup, and the psychology behind their product split is fascinating to me.
It's very smart.
They recognize that the gap between knowing you should hold your own keys and actually successfully moving your coins off an exchange is massive.
It's a huge cliff for most people.
It is. It's a moment of high friction where people give up or make terrible mistakes. So they split the product into two tiers to address two totally different states of the user journey.
Right. They introduced the Jade Core and the Jade Plus.
So the Jade Core is essentially the bunny hill. It's priced at $99. It has this highly streamlined 5-minute setup process, and its singular focus is just getting your coins off an exchange safely with minimal cognitive load. You pair it over Bluetooth, you write down your backup phrase, and you are done. The friction is gone.
Which is exactly what a beginner needs. But for the advanced user, they built the Black Diamond Run, which is the J Plus, at $149.
And what does that add?
This is where you introduce fully air-gapped QR code signing, a built-in camera, and advanced multi-signature support. They're acknowledging that forcing a beginner to manage air-gapped QR data transfers usually just results in them abandoning the process entirely. Usability is a core component of security.
If it's too hard to use, people won't use it.
Exactly. And software developers are pushing that exact same ethos right now. Like Blue Wallet's release of version 8.0.0, which features a very prominent new offline mode.
Oh, I saw this. It's a highly practical application of air gapping.
It really is. The new offline mode is designed to let you take an old, disconnected smartphone. One where you have physically removed the SIM card and wiped the Wi-Fi settings and repurpose it into a dedicated air-gapped signing device.
Okay, but so you generate the transaction on your daily phone, which is connected to the internet, right?
Right.
Then how does it get to the offline phone if there's no connection?
Through the camera. The online phone displays the transaction details as a QR code. Your offline phone scans it, uses the private keys stored in its secure enclave to cryptographically sign the transaction, and then it displays a new QR code representing the authorized signature.
Ah, and then your online phone scans that and broadcasts it to the network.
Exactly. The private keys never communicate over radio waves. The data only crosses the air gap via light.
I love that. And that same mindset of just completely stripping away blind trust is driving the latest update to MBit version 0.8.1.
Yeah, this is a big deal for the DIY community.
For context for everyone, MBit is the core Python library that powers many of the most popular DIY hardware wallets like Spectre, Crux, and SeedSigner. But the main highlight in the release notes is that they removed all bundled native binaries.
Right.
Wait, why is removing code considered a major security upgrade?
Well, it comes down to mitigating supply chain attacks. When a software library includes pre-compiled native binaries, which is basically machine code that is completely opaque to human eyes, you have to blindly trust that the developer's computer wasn't compromised when they compiled that code.
Like the classic Ken Thompson compiler hack.
Exactly. If a hacker infected the compiler, they could slip malicious instructions into the binary that steal your keys, and nobody would be able to see it just by reading the source code on GitHub.
So by stripping out the opaque machine code and relying purely on Python, which is plain text, anyone can audit exactly what the library is doing at all times.
Precisely. It makes the foundational software layer of these DIY wallets significantly harder to silently compromise.
Okay, so we're isolating the hardware, we're air-gapping the keys to protect the human, and we're auditing the code. But eventually, those keys have to actually authorize a payment that moves across the network.
They do.
Which brings up a whole different set of vulnerabilities at the routing layer. The infrastructure layer of the Lightning Network just got a massive engine swap. Core Lightning, or CLN, version 26.06 has officially shipped.
Yeah, and the most significant addition here is an experimental feature called BootWatch.
Right, and it's being called a monumental architectural shift in how a Lightning node monitors the blockchain.
It really changes the game for node runners.
But hold on. The release notes call it an architectural shift, but to a layman, BootWatch just sounds like a minor software patch. What was fundamentally broken about how nodes worked yesterday that required a shift?
Well, historically, running a Lightning node involved a tremendous amount of brute force processing.
Okay.
Your Lightning node had to constantly ask your Bitcoin node, like, every 30 seconds for the latest block data. When a block arrived, the Lightning node had to manually read through the entire block, parsing thousands of irrelevant transactions just to see if any of the script pub keys matched your specific Lightning channels.
That sounds like calling the post office every 30 seconds to ask if they have a letter for you, and when they finally say yes, you have to personally sort through every single piece of mail in the entire city just to find your one envelope.
That is the perfect analogy. And for large routing nodes, or nodes running on low-powered hardware, it was a massive drain on processing power.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But BootWatch changes this entirely. Instead of that brute force polling, it utilizes an asynchronous order one or O of one in-memory hash table lookup.
Okay, wait, hold on. O of one in-memory hash table, you just lost me and probably half the audience.
Fair enough, fair enough.
If I'm running a node on a cheap Raspberry Pi sitting on my bookshelf, what does that string of computer science jargon actually mean for my hardware?
Okay, in simple terms, O of one just means constant time. In the old system, the larger the block, the longer it took your node to search through it. It was a linear search.
Right. More mail means more time sorting.
Exactly. A hash table reorganizes the data so that the time it takes to find a specific transaction is constant, whether the block has 10 transactions or 10,000.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, BootWatch acts as an intelligent filter. It monitors the chain and instantly alerts your node only when there is a mathematical match. Furthermore, it saves this filtered data locally.
So if your Raspberry Pi crashes during a mempool spike and restarts,
it doesn't have to rescan the last 3 days of blocks from scratch. It just reads the BootWatch save file and catches up instantly.
That is a massive reduction in the hardware burden for the average user.
It is.
And alongside BootWatch, the sources mention an overhaul to the payment commands. The legacy pay command is being deprecated, replaced by XPay, which introduces enhanced privacy through something called shadow CLTV additions.
Right.
What exactly is a shadow CLTV?
So to understand the shadow edition, you need to know what CLTV is. It stands for check lock time verify.
Okay.
In the Lightning Network, when you route a payment through intermediary nodes, you attach a timeline, basically a deadline. It dictates how long a node has to claim the forwarded funds before the payment times out and returns to you.
To prevent funds from getting stuck forever.
Exactly. So by adding quote-unquote shadow or randomized extra time to those locks along the route, XPay basically masks the final destination of the payment from surveillance nodes.
So it's like sending a package through five different couriers, but intentionally giving the middle couriers fake extended deadlines?
Yes.
That way, a surveillance courier in the middle can't mathematically deduce if they are the last stop on the route or just a middleman with an artificially inflated deadline.
That is exactly the mechanism. Surveillance nodes try to guess where a payment is going by analyzing the remaining time locks. If the time lock is very short, they assume the destination is close. By randomizing those values, XPay breaks that heuristic completely, making the network fundamentally more private.
And that desire to mask routing destinations isn't just a technical quirk, right? The sources highlight it as part of a much broader culture in this space. It's a culture that prioritizes avoiding digital surveillance wherever possible.
Absolutely, which is perfectly illustrated by the 10-year anniversary of the OpenDime by CoinKite this week.
10 years, that's insane.
I know, a full decade.
For a decade now, this little USB stick has served as the ultimate physical bearer instrument for Bitcoin. You load it with sats, you physically hand it to someone else, and the value transfers completely off-chain.
No apps, no accounts, no exchange surveillance.
None of it. It forces you to rethink the actual mechanics of digital transfer.
And, you know, if you want to avoid surveillance on the acquisition side as well, The sources also document the emergence of a service called privatehash.net.
I found this fascinating because it bypasses the traditional exchange model entirely.
Completely bypasses it.
How do you acquire Bitcoin through this without buying it from an exchange?
So Private Hash allows users to acquire freshly mined Satoshis via hash rental. You pay a Lightning invoice, provide a brand new receiving address, and you are essentially renting computational power from the ocean mining pool.
Okay.
When the pool successfully mines a block, your portion of the block reward is directed straight to your address from the Coinbase transaction.
And the Coinbase transaction being the very first transaction in a block where new Bitcoin is minted.
Exactly.
So you aren't buying someone else's old Bitcoin with a whole history attached to it. You are getting pristine UTXOs, unspent transaction outputs that have zero past history and no heuristic tracing attached to them.
Yep. And you're doing it without providing KYC data to an exchange. Furthermore, the hash power you rent through this service is directed specifically to the ocean pool, which actively signals for BIP 110.
The sources mention that signaling, but what is BIP 110 and why does it matter where the pool directs its hash power?
Right. So BIP 110 is a proposal to require a minimum fee for OpRetern data. OpRetern is a function that allows users to embed arbitrary data into the blockchain.
Things like JPEGs or inscriptions.
Exactly. And the argument against this is that non-financial data causes severe blockchain bloat, which directly increases the storage and bandwidth costs for anyone running a node at home.
Right. It pushes the little guy out.
Exactly. So by renting hash power from a pool that signals for BIP 110, you are voting with your wallet to discourage that bloat and prioritize pure financial transactions.
The sources highlight how this appeals directly to the maximalist ethos. By bypassing the exchange and supporting this specific mining pool, they argue it treats financial privacy as a default right, rather than, you know, an optional feature you toggle on in an app.
It demonstrates that when traditional gateways become too restrictive or surveillance heavy, the ecosystem simply engineers a new path around them.
So bringing it all together, the landscape of self-custody is shifting rapidly. We're seeing hardware transparency proving its worth as Tropic Square invites auditors to physically attack their chips with lasers.
Yeah.
We're seeing phishing attacks leverage real Google infrastructure and AI to bypass spam filters and induce panic.
Which is a whole new battlefield.
It really is. But the tools are rising to meet the moment. From Blockstream's tiered hardware off-ramps, to Blue Wallet's air-gapped signing using light instead of radio waves, to Core Lightning's Watch drastically reducing the processing burden on home nodes.
It's an arms race, really. And as the hardware and the software become increasingly secure, the attack vector inevitably shifts back to the human holding the keys.
It always does.
Always. And I want to leave you with a final thought to consider regarding your own security model. We discussed how AI is automating phishing texts to create urgency. But the cost of social engineering is rapidly approaching zero across all mediums, including audio and video.
Oh, man.
Think about your current multi-signature setup or your family inheritance plan. Your hardware might be secure against a laser fault injection in a multi-million dollar lab, but will your personal protocol withstand an AI voice clone of your spouse or your child, calling you in a sheer panic, sounding exactly like them, and begging for a seed phrase because of a fabricated emergency?
That is a deeply chilling scenario to prepare for, but it's where we are.
The hardware is secure. It is time to seriously audit your human protocols.
A massive thank you for joining us in this week's deep dive into the sources. If you found this episode useful for sharpening your self-custody craft, please take a moment to rate the podcast and leave a comment on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It genuinely helps others find the signal through the noise. Stay sovereign and stay sharp.
Hold your own key. Stay sovereign.